coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Hello, everybody. How you doing this Tuesday evening? Doesn't seem like we are midway through December of 2023, man. This year has just flown by amazingly fast. So I hope everybody has had a great year as I had. Curious Realm got to go out and sponsor so many epic, awesome events and be a part of so many awesome communities. I cannot wait to go out and do the same thing next year. Our first guest tonight here in just a moment is Dr. Irina Scott. We actually met Dr. Scott at MUFON Symposium this last year. We had her on for a little bit talking briefly about Beyond a Reasonable Doubt, the book that her and Philip Mantle have released on the Pascagoula alien abduction. We will be talking about that in our first segment, as well as how events like that affect people for the remainder of their life. It was all of a few months ago that Calvin Parker left us and left this earth. So we will talk about how events like this stay with you and change your life. And how it affected Calvin's life and how it affected Charlie's life. One wanted to tell the story, one didn't. So we'll get into that and what that does to friendships, relationships, communities, everything. And then in the second part of our show, Godspeed to you out there, Clyde Lewis, tonight. I hope you are well, my friend. I'm so sorry to hear about your hurt foot. Clyde Lewis is not on the air this evening. They are running repeat, if I'm not mistaken, or fill-in material. But we have an unheard interview from Clyde Lewis in our second part. I had the opportunity all of a couple weeks ago. They contacted me to be a fill-in guest. I sat in and we talked about AI and the future of humanity. It was a fantastic segment on the show. It was such an honor to be on there. And we enjoyed the conversation so much. Clyde was like, what are you doing tomorrow? Let's get together and have more conversations. So hopefully we will be having many more conversations with the amazing Clyde Lewis here on this show, talking about the things that move humanity. When we talk with Clyde in the second part after commercial, we will be talking about paradigms of control, the ways in which media, the ways in which governments control dialogues, the way in which companies control dialogues, the way in which society controls dialogues. And is that good? Is that bad? Does that lead to authentic humanity? Or are we staring down the barrel of really big troubles coming along down the line? When it comes to the conversation of humanity and what we are going to do with each other, how we're going to approach the future together. So, great conversation with Clyde in the second part after our commercial break, folks. In our first segment, once again, the amazing Irina Scott. She is the co-author of Beyond a Reasonable Doubt, The Pascagoula Alien Abduction. We will be getting into that tonight. Irina, I mean, geez, what hasn't she done? She has did her postdoctoral work at Cornell University. She worked at the Defense Intelligence Agency, reviewing photogrammetry, all kinds of things. Her career goes on and on for years. She has a degree in biology. The PhD is there for a reason, folks. Welcome back to the show, Irina Scott. How are you doing this evening, ma'am?
Just fine, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I am so glad that you're here tonight, despite being down with the COVID right now. considering the fact you have COVID, you sound amazing. So, you are a spry cuss indeed. Whenever I had a chance to meet you at MUFON, we had many conversations into the late evening. So, I thoroughly enjoyed our time together as well as our interview time together. And I'm so glad to have you back on the show tonight.
And it was nice to meet you twice or several times there.
Well, let's go ahead and how did you come to the world of UFO UAP investigation? Before we get into Pascagoula, things like that, let's get a little bit into your bona fides, doctor, and exactly what you studied and how that brought you to the world of examining satellite photographs for the Department of Intelligence. Or the Defense Intelligence Agency, rather.
Well, I started out by wanting to be an astronomer. And I majored in it for a while and started looking for jobs. And everything was male only. And so I wasn't even allowed to apply for jobs, even though I'd majored in it. So I tried to get in through the back door, and they were making maps, and the government would hire female cartographers. And so I got into that, but I didn't get to map other planets. I just got a high security clearance, and I just wound up on Earth. So I tried again, and I went to the Defense Intelligence Agency, and I was hoping to get something else there, but instead I worked in Air Order of Battle, which was kind of interesting in that it was identifying airplanes from satellite photography and whatever else was flying around. Then I still couldn't get an astronomy, and I got married. So, and my husband worked in Las Vegas. He had actually worked in Area 51.
Oh, wow.
And then he was still in Las Vegas, and he got a job there. And so I moved there and got a master's from an ecologist and a PhD from another. There was no astronomy department at the University of Las Vegas, but I got a master's, and they didn't have a PhD. So I got a PhD in the University of Missouri in the College of Veterinary Medicine. And then I went to Cornell, and I became a professor at St. Bonaventure University. And then due to husband's change and so on, we moved back to Ohio. And I had a job in medical college on a grant, and also worked for the Ohio Department of Health. And then in my part-time jobs, I also worked for Popular Mechanics and got to be an astronomer. For a while, the Big Ear telescope, which is now doesn't exist, but it was where they found the WOW signal.
Yep. That is, and that in and of itself is a WOW moment, Irina, to have even gotten to work anywhere in proximity of that instrument. Go ahead.
It was great. They had to take it down, because Ohio State University sold the land under it to be a golf course, so it no longer exists.
That sounds about typical. The golf course is much more lucrative than the science.
It certainly is.
And you know, that is sadly the way so many different times. We were talking about it just before the episode that, you know, the idea that science doesn't always get its hands dirty. The prime example would be NASA not looking into UFOs, UAPs for decades because, people that did look into them were ridiculed, you know?
Yeah. And like, for instance, one of the prime ridiculers back then was Phil Klass, and he always presented himself as a scientist, he would always say, this is a voice of science. This is a voice of science, and I'm a scientist. Well, he wasn't a scientist. He was a writer. But so he sort of led the way to scientists saying, oh, we don't believe in that.
Now, especially with your work with popular mechanics, because, I mean, popular mechanics and popular science were, along with Omni magazine, three of the things that were the staples of my youth, from junior high all the way through college and beyond. And there were regularly articles about, you know, UFOs, exotic technology, all kinds of things. Were you of the mind that UFOs existed during that time? At what point did you come to the world of UFO UAP study, Irina?
Well, I came to it when I was really, really young, and before it might have even been before I was in school. My sister and I had a UFO type experience when we were kids. It was years before we ever heard of UFOs, and then I had other UFO sightings, but I went into science because there is no study of UFOs, obviously, and kept quiet about it for quite a few years. But I had a UFO type experience before anything else when I was just a very young child. My sister and I had several of them together.
That is remarkable. How many did y'all experience together, Irina?
Well, we had two very close encounters together, and then we had separate ones too. But like the first one, we didn't know it was a UFO until many years later. We just didn't know what it was, and we'd never heard of UFOs when it happened.
How old were you when these instances occurred?
Well, I think the first one, my sister said she was definitely not in school yet, and I don't remember. So she might have been 4 and I might have been 6, but we might have been younger than that. Mm-hmm. And it was what you'd call today a bedroom sighting. It was summer and night, and it was a clear night, and I know that for reasons. We both went to bed and went to sleep, and I woke up. I didn't know she was awake at the time. And I saw this thing flying around the room. It was like a little, it was like a real literal tic-tac, actually. Now they talk about tic-tacs. It looked like a little piece of iron, real hot iron, molten iron maybe. And it was just flying, just kind of browsing, flying around the room.
Interesting.
And I had no idea what it was, and I was curious. It came close to us several times, and after a while I began to notice that it didn't run into anything. If it came toward a wall, it turned. If it went around furniture and stuff, and the room was dark. And it came close to both of us, and I was just curious and wondered what on earth it was. Then, after a while, it flew up to the ceiling on the south side of the room and didn't hit the ceiling. It turned. There was a chandelier in the middle of the room, and it was an attic room with walls that slope up toward the ceiling and about 3 feet between them, and the chandelier was in between the two walls, and it flew to the chandelier, and it didn't you know, feel its way around or anything. It seemed to know where the chandelier was. It began to circle it. And then it circled for quite a while and seemed to speed up a little bit. And then it slowly, in a spiral, just went under the chandelier. And suddenly, about the time it was right below the chandelier, my sister and I both became absolutely terrified, just terrified beyond belief, and ran out of the room. We were so scared we fell down the stairs. We couldn't get the door open because we were so terrified.
Yeah.
We went screaming to our parents, and they didn't believe us. So that was our first experience.
Wow. And, you know, Looking back on that now, knowing what you do from investigations, things like that, having sat on the MUFON board, working with MUFON, other investigations, what kind of sighting would you say you had, Irina?
I found out the most about it from a book by Jenny Randall's called Star Children. Mm. He said that oftentimes people that have repeater sightings or more than one sighting when as adults will often start out as kids having like small orbs and yeah. off in their bedroom. And that fit us to a T. I didn't understand anything about it until then because I didn't even know. At that time, we'd never heard of UFOs. We were just poor kids in an old farmhouse.
Yeah.
Just a radio. And but we kind of fit the pattern of having sort of an orb-type sighting when we were kids, and then we both had other sightings later, including both of us had together we had another sighting, too.
Wow. Wow. And to know that you because once again, having sightings with people, typically goes one of two ways, Irina. Either it brings you closer together or it drives a wedge between you. It's really interesting. Frequently, it's the fact that the two people who witnessed the event never talk about it again.
Well, I was really lucky in that my sister was honest and she said, you know, the same thing. In fact, she even found material, but I'm sort of in UFOs because they say scientists don't, you know, believe in UFOs and all that. Well, I don't believe in them, but I think there's evidence that they're there. Mm. And my sister has always talked about it too, that she'll talk about it and she wrote reports and everything else. A lot of instances I know where somebody had sightings with other people, the other person wouldn't talk about it at all.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that's from public pressure or harassment or something affects their mind or what, but I was very lucky because I had most of my sightings with other people and got reports from other people.
Awesome. Well, with that in mind, and with this being the topic of conversation, the mutual experience, which is not a common thing, especially when you talk about mutual abduction. Let's go ahead and start getting into the 1973 case of Charlie Hickson and Calvin Parker there in Pascagoula, Mississippi. How did things begin for them that evening, Irina?
Things began with them that evening with they were family friends. The younger man was 18, a teenager, and he was with an older man, Charles Hickson, and he was Calvin Parker, the younger man, and they were family friends. The younger man's father is a friend of Charles and vice versa. They had had their day of work and they decided to go fishing. And that's just a normal thing down there in Mississippi. There's all kinds of water and they were by the Pascagoula River, which goes right out into the Gulf from there. So fishing is something people did all the time. And so they had their day of work and they went fishing. And they were friends. I mean, Calvin was a good friend of Charles's son and so on. So, they finally found a place after looking at a couple of places. Calvin wasn't real happy about it because, Charlie wanted to fish in this one place and had no trespassing signs up. Mm. And Calvin had a new car and they had to walk through a bunch of trash and weeds and everything to get to the place. And it was old broken down pier. And so they started fishing. and they saw this blue thing, and both of them thought it was the police. And Kelvin told Charles that he could go to jail because it was his fault and he wanted to park there and fish. But it turned out to be a lot worse than anything with the police.
Yeah.
It turned out to be a UFO, and they didn't have a previous interest in anything like that. And they were at different stages in their life too. But they had an abduction, and in this case it was the thing came up and it seemed to open up and all this light came out, and three things came out that kind of were just a little bit like people with arms and legs and a head and everything. Two of them grabbed Charlie, and one of them grabbed Kelvin and took him into the object and did like scan them, or gave the impression of scanning him, like a big eye would come out of the wall and go around him and that sort of thing, for both of them just in general, and then deposited him back on the pier. And they thought it was maybe about 15 minutes when they were on board or so. And then they were back, and this changed their life considerably, because they were both conscious and they both remembered it, for one thing.
Wow. Now during that event, because I mean, I have had one event where I saw what I would consider to be a UFO, a literal object flying in the sky. It was an amorphous blob. It was not a shaped craft, lights, anything like that. I wouldn't say I was terrified, but I was definitely awestruck. And even recently, my best friend from high school, Billy, who was there that night, like we've never really talked about it, Irina, until recently. And once again, much more flabbergasted than terrified, but to have something like these creatures with protrusions coming out of their head, claws for hands, no eyes to be seen, things like that, coming out of a craft and taking you, was there a struggle? Did a struggle ensue? Anything like that?
There was no struggle because they were both paralyzed. Mm. The only thing but they were conscious. And that was kind of different, because I think back then, usually anesthesia made you unconscious. And they were conscious, they could move their eyes, but they were paralyzed. And of course that, you know, normally you'd run, although there was no really place any to run there. But they couldn't. They were both grabbed and paralyzed. And I mean, just that by itself with nothing else would be so terrifying you couldn't believe it. Yeah. People talk about sleep paralysis and things like that, and they become terrified of that. But this was worse because they were paralyzed. Something was a hold of them. And then they were taken aboard. They didn't know whether they would be alive or go to a zoo or get killed or anything else. Yeah. They had no idea what was going on. And then held down or whatever, they were paralyzed so they couldn't move. And then finally they were put back. Well, this was just a horrible, horrible experience that would, I mean, they were shaking for some time afterwards and just in shock. Let me see. And you said they had different perspectives on things. Well, the younger man had his whole life ahead of him, and the older man had been through the army and through life and death situations and things like that in a war. And so if you say something like that, you know, I've been abducted by a UFO, everybody would laugh at you. And especially back in 1973, if you're a shipyard worker. So,
well, and it's, you know, my family is from a pretty small town, Irina, Mamou, Louisiana, small one red light town. Pascagoula is not a, at least back then, was not a huge metropolitan city, you know. So yeah, very much the same country attitude, where there would have been quite a bit of ridicule, and there was quite a bit of age gap between Charlie and Calvin. Charlie was like 42 when it happened, something like that. He was in his 40s, right?
Uh-huh.
And Charlie was a young man, like not even 20.
Teenager.
So, now, of course, as you said, they remembered this experience. Now, being traumatized and scared at first, of course, did they maintain being traumatized and scared as the experience went on? Did they become comfortable with it? Were they given a message of any kind by the beings that took them aboard the craft and performed these tests on them? Were they tests or just, or were they just tests or were they experiments?
Well, it gave the impression of that they were being scanned. I don't know if they were or not, but that's the impression that the beings or whatever they are gave. They were, as I mentioned, at two different stages of their life. And yes, they were scared for some time. And also, the younger man didn't want to report anything, but he had his whole life ahead of him, and he didn't want to, you know, go through life being a freak with everybody pointing at that. And it's a UFO nut.
Yeah.
But the other man thought he would be able to stand up to that. And so after it happened, they discussed what to do. The younger man didn't want to say anything, and the older man at first didn't, but then he changed his mind and wanted to. So they had a disagreement there pretty fast. And what's unusual about it is that they both remembered it, and there were two witnesses. And the fact that they didn't do the same thing also sort of supports that they are honest, because, you know, if they both wanted to get together and say the same thing, they would say, oh, yes, we both saw this or something, but the one didn't want to. Then usually abductions take place way out in the boondocks with one person, and you can't prove anything. And often the person doesn't remember it anyway. And if they do remember it, they report it years later. So this was very, very different from a normal abduction experience.
Yeah.
And the older man thought, we should report this, because it might be an invasion, it might happen to somebody else, and so on. And his military experience told him to report it. The younger man, he was engaged, and he didn't want his fiancée with him, and didn't want to go through life being, you know, targeted and harassed. So he was on the other side. But the older man decided to go ahead and report it, which didn't make the younger man real happy. But you can imagine how, even today, if you tried to report that, what would happen? I mean, you'd call up police. They called, they first of all stopped a newspaper, and it was closed. Then they called Kessler Air Force Base, which was close to them. And Kessler said, I mean, it was night. Kessler said they no longer studied UFOs and told them to contact the police. Well, the older man contacted the police and one reason, you know, saying you'll never believe this. And I mean, he had that took courage. And I guess one of the reasons the police dispatcher listened to him was because he heard the other man crying in the background saying, don't report it. But the police had him come in immediately. And this was totally different from a normal abduction where nobody reports it for years and you don't even remember it.
Yeah.
So they went to the police department. The police did an excellent job of investigating. They, first of all, interviewed him separately. Then they put him in a room together, interviewed him together. And then the interviewer left and left him alone. But the police didn't want to be made fun of. And if it was a hoax, they thought if they were alone together and it was a hoax, they would be talking about the hoax. And so they had hidden a tape recorder in the room that the two witnesses didn't know anything about, and recorded their conversation. And the two men were just terrified out of their minds and just, you know, just totally emotional.
Yeah.
And showed that this really happened to them. It showed that they totally believed what they were saying.
They hadn't coaxed each other's statements. They weren't cooperating in any way to try and pull something. And both fully passed polygraph as well. As did the other witnesses, which, you know, once again, it's pretty rare that you have two people present in an abduction, much less additional witnesses to said abduction and incidents. So, and not necessarily that they saw the actual taking of, Charlie and Calvin, but they saw the same craft in the same location where they were taken.
Well, so. Actually, that night, the police had over 50 reports of UFOs that night that came in from people around in that area saying something strange. So there was a lot more documentation that something was going on than just them, which also is very, very unusual. But the other unusual part was that there was, and, you know, they say hoaxers contact the media and want attention. Well, these people did. They had an interview of them on YouTube, and somebody had written in and said, well, my parents saw that. So Philip Mantle went, he's a very good investigator.
Yep.
Contacted them and found out who these parents were and gave me the information for me to call him. He talked to him briefly too. This was the first person I had ever talked to. I talked to the husband and he was a skeptic. He said something about he heard a big splash and maybe something about a blimp or something, and handed it over to his wife. Well, his wife, Maria Blair, said that they were, he was supposed to meet his supervisor on a ship and go out to, supply the oil rigs or something like that. And the supervisor was late and they didn't have cell phones back then.
Oh, you poor dear.
Excuse me.
It's okay.
I have a cell phone, so they
never apologize for being human, Irina.
Well, you said I could not
absolutely
do it. That was my mistake. But anyway, so they were waiting for the supervisor to show up in the car. The man went to sleep. Maria was in the car, and she saw this, what she interpreted as an airplane, and it was flying around. And she kept saying that it didn't seem to know where it was going, that it just seemed to be flying around and going nowhere. There was no landing strip or anyway or anything like that there. And she thought the pilot was lost or was hunting for something or something. Then about 9 o'clock, her husband said that decided to take his clothes down to the, put him in the boat. And so they were walking along the pier and she was behind him and something flopped up on the pier right in front of her, which she said looked like a man. She said, and then it went back down, and it never came up for air. And this seemed very, very, very strange to her.
You think? So,
yeah. So anyway, they went on down to the boat and ship, and she came around 12 o'clock. She came back, and she didn't exactly explain why she came back at that late. But she was terrified and ran back down the pier to the boat, to the car, and jumped in and left. And you could tell she was really, really emotional. about this thing that flopped up on the pier in front of her. And she kept talking about it. She had all this emotion, but she didn't seem to know why she was emotional about it. And that kept on for about 2 years. Then her husband became very ill, and he was unfortunately died later. And just as he was ready to go in a ventilator, in a ventilator, you can't talk. And so just as he was ready to go in a ventilator, he told her that he remembered the abduction and that he had been in contact with these beings previously and hadn't told her, and had made some kind of a pact with them not to hurt her. But this was all news to her because she didn't know what was going on. Then, so anyway, after that night, when they were waiting on the pier, they had seen activity on the other side of the river, on the other side of the Pascagoula River, and didn't know what it was. But the next day after that, the newspaper carried this story about the abduction, and so they thought they had seen it then. And then later, he said they'd been abducted, which was about 2 years later. And so she began to understand what was going on with her too, that she'd seen these beings and they had abducted them. And when she had this emotional feeling about this thing that flopped up, well, that's probably when she'd been abducted.
And yeah, because of missing time, what have you, and even the idea of this thing flopping up out of the water and going back into the water, just strange. And once again, right there in proximity to the actual abduction site. So, how did these events affect Calvin and Charlie for the remainder of their life, Doctor?
Well, I think Charlie was able to handle it. He had a lot of experience, and he'd been through life and death situations, and probably just getting harassed by his fellow people probably didn't make that much difference to him if he's just escaped death in Vietnam and things like that. Whereas Calvin hadn't had any of those experiences, and he had his life ahead of him. So he was very worried about the whole thing and didn't want to say anything, which is a normal response that anybody would have. I mean, Calvin is more like a normal person. So they, you know, became suspicious of each other somewhat because Calvin didn't know why this had. The next day after they went to work, and there were all these reporters and all kinds of newspaper people and everything else around, so they couldn't even work. And he thought this was due to Charles saying something, but actually, in my own opinion, I talked to a policeman, and he said that right after it happened, right after they had contacted the police and were in there, that a bulletin had gone out that said the police on the police radio that they said two drunks had been over in the river and thought they'd been abducted or something. Some kind of weird thing went out on the police radio. Mm. I would suspect that that's how it got out instead of from anybody else. But he was sort of unhappy with Charlie for many, 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 many years. And he had a really bad reaction to it because, first of all, he lost his job, which was due to all the commotion. It wasn't due to his job. It was due to all the commotion about everything. He went home to his family. He had a nervous breakdown and was hospitalized for a while. I mean, he still wasn't talking about it. He talked about it for nearly 50 years. Wow. And But it was obviously it happened to him because of the secret tape, and the secret tape's on this on the internet now,
yep.
and transcribed and everything, so people know exactly what they said. And he was well aware of being captured and everything then, but he didn't want to talk about it. But I interviewed his wife, and his wife said that for a long time afterwards, he had a tick in his mouth, which is just a nervous tick. Mm. And he didn't talk about it to anybody for like 48 years or something. And so they had totally different reactions to it.
Yeah, and I mean, it sounds like he had an actual physical manifestation of suppressed trauma, you know?
He did.
And once again, these effects, emotional and physical, can be lifelong and lifelong lasting. Did they have any adverse physical effects? I mean, aside from the tick, were there any radiation burns, marks, anything like that from the procedures on the craft, Irina?
Robin was very worried about it because he was worried he might be radioactive or he might be contaminated and spread. And he went home that night and bagged his clothes in a plastic bag or something and threw them out in the trash. And then he took a bath, and I think he said he poured bleach on himself, which is something his mother did to clean him. And so he was thoroughly cleaned and worried. And then he was worried, you know, they might be contaminated, and he said something about it. And they first of all took him to a rural hospital, Singing River Hospital, and they didn't have facilities for radiation or anything. So then, but the Kessler Air Force Base didn't. And although that night Kessler said, "We have no inners," the next day they took him to Kessler to examine him and see if they had any old radiation or any contamination. At that time, Kessler Air Force Base had a lot of people, you know, big people interview them, such as colonels and medical doctors and things like that. So they had a whole bunch of people ask him what happened. And there's a transcript of that in our book, too. They had a it wasn't recorded, but they had a secretary making notes. And so there's a transcript of all the questions they asked him then. So it was very well documented, just unbelievably.
Yeah, the book is amazing. It has all kinds of pictures, news articles. Like, it is literally just a dossier of the event. Absolutely remarkable. Everything down to parts of transcripts from regression sessions, things like that. Now, when it comes to the issues, because once again, Charlie and Calvin's families were friends. They knew each other via family, things like that. And this obviously set something off between them. Did they ever make up before Charlie's passing or anything like that, Irina?
I think there was some resentment on Calvin's part the whole time, but I think he thought that Charlie had told people. Okay. And I don't think Charlie had. I think it came from the police department, but I think he kind of blamed him from then on. But he had a much worse reaction, but he was very, very young, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, they can, I mean, any experience like this. And now, after their experience, because once again, traumatic for them, terrifying for them during the moment. Yet afterward, when they were asked about things, they encouraged people not to encourage any violence toward these creatures that, you know, that they meant no harm.
Yeah, I think later they said that they somewhat received messages that they meant no harm and that sort of thing from the aliens. Mm. Both of them seemed to have that impression.
And once again, to vividly remember something like this, because most frequently there is missing time, time gaps, things like that. The memories of these two gentlemen, when you go through and start reading things, when you listen to that tape, are visceral and real. Oh, they're visceral.
They were shaking.
Yeah.
And just, you know, I think it was some time before they just got back to kind of being themselves. And I think that was quite a while for Calvin.
Yeah. And I mean, this, of course, this last October was the 50th anniversary of the event. And so much in the world of ufology, UFO, UAP research, abduction research, even experiencer outreach that exists now, and experiencer support groups like MUFON's, you know, experiencer resource team, things like that, Irina. What do you think this case in particular, how do you think this affects the conversation moving forward?
Well, I'm hoping it does, because the conversation so far is the government has acknowledged that there may be things UAP here that aren't explainable. And that's about as far as they've gone.
Yeah.
And their evidence is military planes photographing them, putting on radar and things. But it seems that people have actual experience, such as close encounters, which is a lot closer than a picture on a radar screen. And they're not talking about that as yet. And usually most of the close encounters often are things people don't remember, people, there's no more witnesses, and all that sort of thing. Well, in this case, there's this is a close encounter, an abduction, and that sort of thing. But there's quite a bit of other evidence to support it, which maybe I hope we're making pathways to having it acceptable that people not only see them at a distance, but they may even see them more closely.
Well, and you know, Irina, there was a day and time where sadly, you kept quiet if you were molested, if you were sexually harassed, things like that. Those times are gone now, and for the best. I think it is very much the same way when it comes to these experiences and paranormal experiences, that people are finally getting the internal fortitude to come forth with their experiences, because they're no less traumatizing,
Yeah. Like before, if a woman was raped, well, they would say she was lying, and the man would say to the male judges, she's lying, this didn't happen. And usually men don't rape women in public, so there's nothing the woman can do about it.
Yeah,
but it's more acceptable now that, and especially since they can, you know, get inside and get the DNA and stuff to say, yeah, something happened here.
Yeah,
and it's very much the same as the abductions.
Well, and it's one of those. It's not a comfortable conversation, Irina, but it's one that has to be had. You know, it's not a comfortable conversation to talk about those things with a teenage kid, you know, but you have to have the conversation at some point. And it's very much the same way with these experiences. We have to be ready to have the conversation, because once again, like I just had the Live Science article up a second ago, about the Pentagon document talking about, you know, radiation burns and unaccounted for pregnancies, things like that. Like the Pentagon reports have gone deep as of late, And it's interesting to see that that conversation is open in those channels now. Whereas before, much like NASA, they would not have avowed talking about it.
Yeah. And, like if a woman complained about my boss raped me, she got fired.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, if scientists talked about it, they would probably, I mean, I sure didn't say anything when I worked for the DIA, and that my sister and I had a close encounter experience then too, but I didn't, I wrote down, got notes and everything, but I didn't report it on account of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's just it. You know, there are numerous people who held offices, things like that, that had experiences that never reported things because of fear of losing their office, fear of losing their pension, fear of losing a career, be it military or private contracting, you know? And you know, I've got to ask before I let you go here in a couple of minutes, Irina, I've got to ask, when you worked for the DIA and you were doing photogrammetry and looking at high resolution satellite images, things like that, did you ever see anything?
Once I just brought it up just in an abstract way of UFOs, and to my surprise, my supervisors were open-minded, and they said they had seen something and reported it as a UFO, and they were both very might say stressed out about it. It was right before I got in their section. They said that their supervisors told them that it didn't exist and it was a spot on the film. Well, they showed it to me and I could change the apparent size and everything on the photography and get it in stereo and things. There were two photographs. So it definitely wasn't a spot on the film. But they said that their supervisors just insisted it was a spot on the film, and they sent it to some other authorities who also said no spot on the film. And so they were just put out because they were supposed to be the top people at doing this photo analysis.
Yeah.
And they just told them they were crazy, which, you know, I mean, at that time, I was in the closet with UFOs and everything, but made an impression on me that somewhere in the government, probably somebody knows something. Of course, it could be their supervisors didn't know anything too, but you know, I had the impression that maybe they were lying or something.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's just it. So much of that stuff is fully compartmentalized in the private sector, things like that. But it was just one of those, like, I've got somebody here who spent years looking at high detailed satellite images. So I had to ask if you ever saw anything whizzing by, you know, in one of those images. So, because yeah, I think there's kind of sadly a misconception out there, Irina. And that is a lot of what we like to do on this show is demystify things, have the conversations that people don't like having. And, you know, I think there's a misconception out there that these things are photographed with regularity, you know, things like that. We need to be looking at the anomalies and yeah. Remember the fact that anomalies are anomalies. They do not occur in great number, you know, as somebody who examine photographs for years and years. I'm sure you, much like myself, can spot things pretty rapidly, you know? And it's amazing what is out there now, software wise, AI wise, to be able to generate things. So, the next few years are going to be challenging, to say the least, with data like that, you know? But having conversations about incidents like Pascagoula, about how those incidents were handled by police, law enforcement, whether they were taken seriously or ridiculed, and quite obviously in this case, taken very seriously by the local police, to the point of investigating if they were lying, colluding, and even to the point of polygraph, and all of that was passed.
Yeah, and so even by today's standards, that was an extremely well-investigated event.
Yep.
And if it happened today, it might not be even closely that well-investigated.
Well, and that's kind of the caveat that I give people with evidence. My air quotes are up for all the listeners out there who aren't watching. but, you know, when it comes to evidence or, ooh, I got evidence in a picture, air quotes again. You have to be careful with that because, there are so many things that happen, especially with digital equipment. And it's hard to say that you definitively have something.
And the trouble is the phenomenon itself may be able to affect things such as the electronics on a camera or what it's taking a picture of. Maybe they send a laser right down into the camera lens and give you a different picture or something. So that they always say everything is blurred. And they act like that's because everybody blurs it because they're faking. Well, that's not true. I mean, there may be a lot of reasons.
Oh, yeah.
Everything's blurred a lot of the times.
Well, yeah, precisely. And just the fact of vibrational fields, things like that, when you're talking about craft of this type, you know, anything that would be able to defy gravity, anything that would be able to have an anti-gravitic field or teleportation or even light diffusion for cloaking abilities. You are talking about a high RF vibrational field. You know?
About something that seems impossible, such as the things seem to levitate and they seem to levitate them. You know, and gravity is pretty common all over the place. So,
yeah.
That causes people not to believe it, but this may be a phenomenon that's way different than what we understand.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And once again, we have to be willing to listen to people's experiences. We have to be willing to, much like the police did with Charlie and Calvin, we have to be willing to investigate further and see where it actually leads us with open mind. You know, I mean, they could have very easily taken that report, sent them on their way, and tossed it right in the bin, Irina.
I mean, that,
which is the case in most of them.
Yeah, with the police work, because they did a really good job of investigating, and that's one reason it's a real good example.
Well, and when it comes, once again, to that evidence of like, hey, I caught this on my camera. The question I always ask people is, would you be willing to have that defend your life in court?
Well, lots of people
would. Is it that level of evidence, air quotes again, that you just caught, you know? And quite literally, yes, that is the realm of evidence that the police got.
Uh-huh.
Was evidence that would have been able to exonerate somebody in court.
That's why we called it beyond reasonable doubt.
Yeah, it is remarkable, the information that is in this book. This is probably hands down one of the most well documented cases, Irina, and you and Philip Mantel have done an amazing job putting all of this information together, just reams and reams of data, everything from news articles to diagrams, images, you know, once again, transcripts of regression sessions, transcripts from the police tapes. It is all in there. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate your time coming on and talking about this. I would love to have you and Philip on to talk about it. If you're out there listening, Philip, we need to make that across the pond communication happen so that we can get both of you guys on here and go into this even deeper. Where can everybody go not only to get the book, Irina, but where can they go to keep up with your work? Where can they go to follow you and keep abreast of the latest things that you are investigating, researching, writing about, things like that?
Well, my book, all the books so far have been by Flying Disc Press, which is Philip Mantle's publisher, and he does a lot for his authors, such as getting them on podcasts and things like that. My website is irinascott.com, and I have my latest information there, and that's my latest book, Aliens and the Apocalypse. It's coming out next year.
Oh, wow. Well, we've definitely got to have you back on to talk about that one.
Great.
Irina, thank you so much for a fantastic and candid conversation about, once again, a very deep and thick topic. The Pascagoula case is one that, I mean, you can talk about for hours and hours. There are reams of data on it. It's absolutely amazing. And once again, you guys have done a fantastic job culling all of that together and bringing that together for what is an amazing experience and story from both of these gentlemen, whose lives were changed and even after, held no ill will toward the beings that did that to them. You know, absolutely amazing and a true, true lesson as to what we as humanity should be with these experiences. Not only open-minded, but open-hearted, you know. So any last words, Irina?
Well, I hope we're making some little progress toward getting the close encounter phenomena taken seriously, too, because they aren't just far away. They seem to be close.
Yeah.
And we need to find out more about it because it affects lots of people's lives and maybe the whole destiny of the human race for anybody knows.
Yep. Yeah, precisely. Precisely. And we have to be ready. It's like we talk about with our guest Keith Seeland all the time. Are we ready to have the conversation with them? You know, because until we are, I don't know if that conversation's going to happen. You know,
and we're pretty primitive in lots of ways.
Very, very primitive in a lot of ways.
More advanced, we'd probably be paying attention to now. And
yeah.
Yeah. Trying to interact. Someone.
Absolutely. Well, Irina, thank you so much for your time tonight. I greatly appreciate it. While you are literally racked with COVID, you poor dear. You couldn't ask for a better Christmas present.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. And thank you very much.
Oh, anytime. Absolutely. You are always welcome on the show. It's always a pleasure to chat with you. Always a pleasure to talk with you both online and off.
Yep.
Take care of yourself during the holidays. Get well, and I will be sharing links with you very rapidly. So,
okay.
All right. Take care.
Doing a great job.
All right. Talk to you soon, Irina.
Okay.
Bye-bye. An amazing conversation there, folks, with Dr. Irina Scott. Once again, beyond reasonable doubt, an amazing book. About an absolutely phenomenal case. If you are into UFO UAP cases, the Pascagoula abduction is just one of those that once you start tearing into it, man, there is just so much meat on the bone because it's so well documented. Amazing stuff. Once again, stop on by and check out the amazing work of Dr. Irina Scott at irinascott.com. Everybody, that is where you can buy her books. Of course, you can also buy her books right here at curiousrealm.com/store. That's where you can buy all the books from our guests. That's also where you can buy your Curious Realm merch, like the cup I've been drinking out of during the show. That's also where you can go and find all of our videos. CuriousRealm.com/videos. That's where you can go and subscribe to all of the YouTube channels of our guests. Everything else, they are all right there so that you ain't got to go searching, everybody. It's all right there on our website. Stay tuned through these commercial breaks. When we come back, everyone, we will be joined by the indomitable Clyde Lewis. We had an amazing conversation with Clyde about AI, authenticity, and humanity, where that is going. And we continued that conversation on this show, talking about paradigms of control, everything from how 9/11 affected the political paradigm and the paramilitary paradigm, and how the paradigms are pushed by the media, how these paradigms are driven to drive wedges in between us in society. So when we get back from this commercial break, everybody, we will be airing that incredible pre-recorded interview. Just so you know, guys, always, sometimes we have folks trying to ask live questions during the second part. The second part is always pre-recorded. That is how I get things out so quick. So anyway, stay tuned through this commercial break, everybody. When we come back, we'll be talking with Clyde Lewis from Ground Zero with about paradigms of control. Right after this, everybody. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more, and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com, and the code is CURIOUS7.
Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training, and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com.
Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is your source for spigerically made CBD oil, folks. I'm here to tell you I've used CBD all over the country. They are hands down some of the best CBD I have ever used. Stop by and check them out. Curious 7 is the code that you want to use to get 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. Stop on by their website, everybody, truehimscience.com. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Clyde Lewis, host of Ground Zero. Welcome to the show, Clyde. How are you doing today?
Good, Christopher. It's good to be on your program. It's great. Had a chance to talk with you last night. What a remarkable show we did together. The hour was packed with a lot of enthusiasm, and I was very excited to be a part of it because it was we're feeding off of each other in such a way, and it's important that that can happen, that we have the synergy, I think, with all the people out there to get the truth out there, or maybe even a version of it that not very many people have heard.
Well, you know, and that is what I love about listening to your show. That is what you are, despite the topics that you cover, which are wide and ranging. Like I have touched on New World Order things. I can't say as I've done full on episodes on it yet. But your topics are so wide and ranging, yet still you have a grounded point of view when it comes to looking at them. Prime example would be at the beginning of the show last night, you were talking about the possible use of holograms at 9/11, things like that. For control of the masses and control of a paradigm. And you were like, okay, possibly, I guess they could have, but why not just use planes? You know, why not just go with the old solid analog way of doing things, you know, the tried and true methods. And to look at things that way, I think, is one of the most important things in the world right now in our society. Because,
well, I always wonder why people, you know, they come up with these wild conspiracy theories. And I love a good conspiracy theory. Don't get me wrong. Conspiracy theory should be a part of history. It should be taught.
Yeah.
The problem I have, though, is sometimes these outrageous conspiracy theories, like, well, they used holograms instead of planes. Okay, so what's the motive of using a hologram? What is the benefit of using a hologram as opposed to, you know, killing all those people with real planes? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, what do they have to do with all the bodies that were on those planes? I mean, it's just too much trouble to cover up something by just using holographic planes. I don't get it. I mean, the impact wouldn't be the same. I'm sure, though, and this is the thing, a lot of conspiracy theory has a lot of kernels of truth in it.
Oh, absolutely.
So I would say this. If holographic planes were used at all, it would be used in the reporting of the World Trade Center, meaning that a lot of technical wizards would go in and they would give us views of the planes going in that never happened. In other words, they want to get the best picture. They want to get the best show. And so they weren't prepared to have the cameras rolling at the time the plane slammed in. They had them at certain angles, but not the best angles. So they went back and said, well, can we recreate that for a more impactful thing? I know that news media does that. They do it all the time. They want to. They don't get the impact they want. I remember when Shock and Awe happened.
Yep.
I had a friend of mine that worked at CNN, and he told me, he said, the bombs weren't loud enough, so they had to go in with a sound effects library and enhanced the bombs so they went off and they were loud.
Yeah, yeah, because they were off in the distance. You know, it's not like they were like louder. Right there. Yeah, exactly, exactly. And, you know, the things like that are done regularly whenever you look at media after the way that things are treated after to make sure that, yes, they are broadcast ready.
Most of the footage you see in wartime, too, is not the footage of the war itself. I mean, that's the thing, is that it has to appear like it's available, because they say if you don't see it, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I think they have to generate it. They have to create it or recreate it. And they do it in a studio. And I think this is where you get the idea. Well, they used holographic planes, or maybe they did to create a new way of seeing it. But no, planes did hit the buildings, and maybe they did work on special effects to get you right front and center and watching a plane going into the buildings.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even here recently, there was the whole claim that the baby in the Syrian photos was a baby doll, not an actual baby, everything else. These things are questioned and put out all the time. And even whenever you're talking about the concept of conspiracy theory, that is used every day in America. I'm pretty sure that there isn't a DA out there that hadn't convicted somebody of conspiracy. Mm-hmm. All they're doing is quite literally weaving a dialogue and saying, jury, come on the journey with us right now. These are the facts as we are going to lay them out. Not necessarily the facts, but the facts as we are going to lay them out to make our case.
That's how police operate. I mean, they come up with a theory as to how a murder or a crime takes place. They banter together and they throw around the theory and try to make a case. And that's where you go to the courts, because they take a conspiracy theory. They put it before the courts. The jury decides whether or not their theory is sound. And lawyers are meant to cast doubt on those theories. That's the whole point of a lawyer.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's how it works. And so the idea of conspiracy theory being a pejorative for lying, you might as well take the whole court system and throw it out in the process.
Thank you. Exactly. Yeah. Like that is literally the basis. If you are not allowed to hypothesize, I mean, the whole point of science is hypothesis it to the extreme. You know, let's hypothesize whatever we can. And through testing and poking and prodding and repetitive science, we will prove whether or not that hypothesis is sound, and it will become a theory.
Sure.
So, yeah, if you want to hypothesize that, you know, planes flew into the World Trade Center, absolutely. Now let's follow the rabbit trail of evidence and see if something actually happened. And it's funny to me how years down the line, these things still have the gas they had in 2000.
Well, right. I mean, one of the other things, too, that I've always asked the question, they talk about direct energy weapons being used on the Twin Towers. And I say to myself, well, what's the motive for that?
Mm.
You know, why do we need that to happen? So we have fake planes and we have direct energy weapons. Why go to all that trouble when you can just do it by slamming two planes into a building? Now, beyond that, the idea of bringing the towers down in a controlled demolition would be something that, again, you know, they poo-poo and they say, well, the planes melted the steel. And I'm thinking, well, here's the thing. They can have the chance of watching these towers topple over and land on other buildings, or they can go in and they can rig charges to make sure the building falls in a way that wouldn't harm other buildings.
Mm.
And I'd say that would be a good motive for that, is that they didn't want to have too much loss of life that they already had. So the idea would be just to flatten the buildings in their own place,
yeah,
their own foundations. So, I mean, and that's what they did with Building 6. And to deny they did it is just insane. No, they did bring the building down. They collapsed in a controlled demolition. It just goes to show you that they have these charges already there, ready to go. The World Trade Center already had a bombing take place long before what happened in 2001. So they were ready for anything, I think.
Oh, that's the whole point. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, when it comes to especially controlling dialogues, controlling people through dialogues, you know, I mean, even the whole idea of the passports that were randomly found, things like that. I remember when I worked on air, having the Boston Marathon happen. And I mean, I was like on the other side of the glass from my host when it happened.
Right.
And some of the things that happened during that, Clyde, were like, wow, wow, jaw dropping.
I have to agree with you. And I'll tell you why, because I remember the Watertown chase.
Yep.
You remember that?
Yeah.
I was on the air. Somebody had called me and they said, you know, monitor the TV going on in Watertown at the moment.
Yep.
And I said, okay. So I monitored it. Everything that was going on, the media was not reporting. It was the scariest thing. They had different names than the suspects that they called out. They actually ran over one of those kids with yep. their police cars and killed him.
Yeah.
But they said that, no, he didn't die that way, but he did die that way. There were so many things that I witnessed and heard on the police radios and everything. And I told one of the guys when I was there from, I guess, 9 o'clock at night. I did the show all the way until 4 a.m. And then by 6 a.m, the whole story changed. But for the morning news. And I said to the morning news guy coming in, I said to him, I said, whatever you hear this morning is not going to be the truth. And sure enough, the suspect's names were different. The whole thing was different. They didn't say anything about his brother being killed or run over by a police car.
Yeah.
None of that. And so to this day, the Boston bombing and the Watertown chase is completely fabricated. The yeah. story you heard about the Watertown chase, completely fabricated. Nothing plays out.
Nothing further from the truth than what was put out. And yeah. once again, that became like a 24-hour news cycle where I worked, man. And I remember getting Ibrahim Todashev, the older brother, had Ibrahim Todashev was the sparring partner of the older brother mm-hmm. of the Boston bombing. And when the FBI went to go, you know, interrogate him, they actively shot him in the top of the head.
Right.
He was handcuffed to a chair. Like, his dad went onto national television with this picture of his son's vivisected body. Like, mm-hmm. look at what the FBI just did to my son.
Right.
There were like 5 FBI agents that were involved with that randomly died in a helicopter training accident about a month or so later, something like that. The older Zarniev brother was caught in Chechnya at a bomb making seminar by Russian intelligence with yep. falsified documents. And they called up and were like, hey, what's your boy doing over here at this bomb making seminar? So like that was just all kinds of whitewash. Everywhere. And to see them quite literally bringing people out of their home at gunpoint,
right.
That's when, to me, it was quite literally like, despite any NWO, anything like that, Clyde, man, that was a big litmus test is truly what I believe as to like on after 9/11, things have settled down, all that kind of stuff. What would we be able to do? What would they put up with? You know, would they put up with armed people coming in and politely asking you to leave your home so we can search it without a warrant?
Well, look at COVID-19. They look at it as a silver lining. They said, this is how easy it was to control a group of people. All you have to do is tell them they're going to die if they step outside and breathe the air. It's, you know, one of the things I've been doing Ground Zero now for about 30 years. And one of the things that I was always telling people, warning them about this day and how it would happen. And I say now, I'm very surprised that America has just knuckled under and not see this for what it is. Yeah. I was not even planning on the idea that everything would be so obvious and people would just roll over and play dead. I'm completely shocked by that.
It gives me chills, man.
Yeah, it just, I don't understand, because it's like, we were warned of this for 30 years, and then now it's happening. People are saying, well, whatever. What? I mean, it's like I was saying last night. You'd go up to somebody and you say, well, this is happening and this is happening. And they say, well, I don't care.
Yeah.
They don't care. I mean, They just don't care. And they're only going to care if it affects them directly. If they're seeing other people suffer, doesn't matter. If they see people overseas suffer, doesn't matter. China could disappear tomorrow and we wouldn't care. It would be like getting a cut on the finger from a piece of paper. And we'd go, oh, that hurts. But, you know, it'll get better.
Yeah.
No big deal. And I just can't believe the ennui that we have here in this country and how we've been so lulled into thinking that everything's going to be okay when we look around and say nothing's okay.
Yeah.
Nothing's okay. And I think they just hit us with crisis after crisis after crisis. People just become numb. And if they don't know what to do, they don't do anything. That's how Americans operate. If you confuse them or overwhelm them to the point where they don't know what to do, they just stand there and do nothing. They do nothing. That's how it works.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, there's that psychological point of fight, flight, or freeze, Clyde. Mm-hmm. And everybody always hears about the first two. They always forget about the third. And that is what most people do.
Americans are good at freezing. They really stand in awe and
just do not know what to do.
From a marketing perspective, I mean, you've been in broadcasting and AV and all this, but you look at the marketing perspective that you always hear from people who want to market, and they say, don't overwhelm anybody with complicated crap, because if you do, they're not going to care. They're not going to participate. You have to make it simple. If you don't make it simple, people will just say, I don't understand it. I'm not going to participate in it. And that's the whole point. They have infantilized this to the point where everything has to be Sesame Street. Everything has to be, 1 + 1 = 2 or 2 + 2 = 5. That's exactly how they're doing it. It's exactly what Orwell said would be done.
Yeah.
And it's just how simplistic everything has become. Nothing complicated, nothing deep. There's not any deep thinking anymore. No big picture thinking. No, oh my God, look in the past and see how we treated each other. We're doing it again. So what? Yep. So what? You know, and everybody has their little Hitler that they want to point out, but no one really knows about Hitler. No one really knows about Stalin or Mao or any of the others that have been oppressors and how they stopped speech and how they took away guns and all these things. They don't even look at that. They're thinking, well, what's going on in America is unique. It's not unique.
No.
In fact, it's oppressive.
It is wash, rinse, repeat, Clyde,
yep.
is what it is. And the example I give to people whenever you're talking about control and how easy it is through control to make a society forget. I'm Cajun. Cajun is one of the only cultures indigenous to right here, America. Mm-hmm. That language is here. It is basically unchanged 15th century court French. That language was all but beaten out of my grandparents' generation by school marms who were like, you need to speak English. Stop speaking the ignorant French. You are hard pressed to find Cajuns that are my mother's age. I'm 50. You're hard pressed to find Cajuns my mother's age or my age that can speak their native tongue. It takes that long to forget. Just that long. One generation, man.
Yeah.
Less than a generation.
It all goes back to what I think Joseph Campbell said about, I think he was the one that said this, or maybe Nietzsche said it. I don't know who said it, but they said something to the effect that the way you kill a god is you ignore him.
Hmm.
The way you kill a language is you ignore it.
Yep.
So if you don't teach it in the schools, how are kids going to learn to speak English, Creole, or whatever they're going to be speaking? They're not going to know. And I mean, you hear the language of the kids today. It's some cockeyed, I don't even know if I can use the word pidgin English, that doesn't make any sense. You're judged by how you speak, but if you speak the way you are, it can also put you at where your age is as well.
Yeah.
And you listen to kids speak today, and they don't even speak like real people. They speak some language that makes them sound like they're dullards, that they don't pay attention in school, that they don't pay attention to the language, they don't pay attention to history, and none of that matters to them. All they want to do is get home and play their video games, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's a scary thing.
Well, you know, and we spoke a little bit about that last night, the whole concept of escapism, you know, and honestly, that is what I see as one of the biggest dangers of AI. Should AI get to the point of sentience, anything like that, man, is
right.
Go ahead. Let it become sentient. Like, put those checks in place, because as soon as it becomes sentient and sees the fact that we used robots for manual labor, that we turned them into sex bots, that we started using AI to make women naked all the time. Like, that's one of the most popular AI apps out there right now, is the one that, you know, you put in somebody's picture and it shows them naked. That's the point of our society right now. And yeah, man, like, if an AI becomes sentient, and that is how you end up with, like, humanity is the disease of this planet. Like, that's how you end up with Agent Smith.
Right.
Right there.
They'll see the behavior and they'll say,
yeah,
How is this needs to survive?
Yeah.
How does this even survive?
Yeah.
It doesn't need to. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and we really do have to watch those caveats within our society, because I'm no religious fanatic. I'm no Bible thumper or anything like that. If that's the term that you use out there, folks, but I don't know. I look at it the same as you. We have lost our way as a society. We have lost our way. I remember when I was a kid hearing vivid conversations with my family politically around dinner tables, things like that, at Christmas, Thanksgiving. You got families ain't even having Christmas or Thanksgiving with anymore because of their political belief, man.
Well, like, and that's the thing. Back to Norman Lear just died.
Yeah.
101 years old. And you and I both grew up on Norman Lear.
He was the conversation, man.
He was the conversation. He's the one that molded the conversation in America. Yeah. In one of his videos that he said, I don't know if you know this or not, but he liked to mosh. He'd go to mosh pits.
Oh, yeah.
He was a really cool guy. And one thing he said, though, at 101, he said, the only thing I can tell you about living to be 101 is I really miss the America of the 70s and 80s. He said there was something about that time where we were all pretty much not taking ourselves that seriously. We were able to talk about politics without getting angry at one another.
Yeah.
We were able to laugh at ourselves. We were able to look at things and not be so ultra sensitive. He says, I don't know what's happened, but he says it's not good for the social cohesion of this country.
Yeah.
And I agree with it. I mean, we need more Norman Lears now. We need more Mel Brooks now. We need those who don't take the society seriously.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Dave Chappelle gets out there and he starts talking about stuff and people immediately say, oh, let's cancel him. But we need Dave Chappelle. We need people like that that look at the world and they can say, well, this doesn't make any sense. And because everybody says, oh, yeah, OK, let's be stupid. Let's all be stupid. OK, that's a cool thing to be stupid. Then you have somebody say, well, wait a minute. That's just stupid. Oh, my God. Cancel him. He said we were stupid. Well, you are. Yeah. That's the whole problem I'm seeing with the it's like what Norman Lear said.
Yeah.
We need to be more aware of just how fragile we are and how we're so easily duped and we're dependent on other people's opinions of us. That's why the Internet exists. But, you know, who gives a shit? Oh, I'm sorry.
We're internet based.
Who gives a damn if you decide you're going to take a picture of your food and put it on the internet? No one cares. No one cares about your shoe size. No one cares about you. It's like, when was it ever cool to sit down at a family gathering or at a party and show your vacation pictures on slides?
Yeah, yeah.
It never was cool. It never will be cool. And people still do that on the internet.
I'm pretty sure that is the nightmare scenario in every family Christmas movie. You know?
Look at my puppies. Yeah. Okay, they were cute for a minute, but now let's move on. Let's have a conversation. Social cohesion's dead. It's just dead because things that we thought were once not cool are cool. And you're like going, why are they? Oh, because they're electronic now. We no longer have to sit around the slide projector and watch upside down slides. We can watch it on the internet.
And, you know, I've watched it with the reboot of my industry, Clyde, as a live AV engineer working in events. I was dragged back into the world of live broadcast during COVID. And it was like, oh, man, I fought for so long to get back to doing live stuff. And now I'm back in a studio producing things across the country and connecting people like this via Zoom all day long.
Right.
You know, and it was interesting, though, to see people come into meetings the same way that they did for a general session, where it would be like, OK, we've got 100 computers set up, everybody. You're going to be welcoming, like, you know, 60, 70 people into a guest room before the GS starts. Like, it was insanity. It was like anything they could do to still have their event, anything they could do. And and now that the world has rebooted, like, it's the same thing. There is a verve for people wanting to get together again, but it's strange that at the same time there is this dissonance, like what you're talking about, where
I feel so guilty about some of the things that I do now that COVID has basically done to me, actually.
Why is that?
Not going to the store anymore.
Mm.
I haven't been to the store in a long time. I order everything online. I have an Instacart account.
So you're helping employ somebody.
Well, yeah, but I just feel like that maybe I should go to the store.
Sure.
I mean, but I don't like, I didn't like the way I was treated during COVID, having to stand in line 6 feet apart.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that kind of shit of stuff. I just don't like it.
Yeah.
And it just turned me off. And so now I feel like, well, I can have it be brought to my door. I don't have to deal with that crap. So I feel guilty about that. I don't travel as much anymore. And so they're actually winning there because I'm not filling the air with carbon. I'm spending more time studying because I value the conversations like what you and I are having and trying to be unique and trying to bring word out to people. I'm valuing that more than I do anything else, because it just seems like everything else has kind of let me down and betrayed me, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just like COVID was the biggest betrayal that ever happened to us.
I would tend to agree. And that is one of the things that I have held on this show for a long time, especially with, you know, fixing our country. There's a big problem when people don't want to vote in regulations on themselves, you know, like our House and Senate. And I've held for the longest time. If you were like, we should pretty much go the same way that they did with the truckers strike back in the 70s. Like if you were deemed essential, with my air quotes up, folks, during the pandemic, stay home for a week.
Let them know.
Guarantee them know you they'll you listen after get, 1 week when there ain't a barista one at a Starbucks, when there ain't anybody chopping meat at the butcher, when there ain't anybody trucking things across the country, you know? That is they the only the power that the working man has.
They were the heroes during COVID.
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that like 80% of them got zero raise after the reboot of the world. It's one of those like, wow. So whenever you're saying, you know, I wish I'd go back to the store, I'm looking at it as good for you. You freed one more person from walking through a door for a soulless person every day. And now they're out making their living with Instacart.
Well, and here's the thing, too.
And doing whatever they want to do.
This is going to sound really weird. It's going to make me sound like the loneliest guy in the world. But here's the thing. I don't like going into a store and being told that I have to go through the electronic checkout.
Yeah.
I am not being paid to be your employee, okay? We're employees that I'm supposed to have done for me. But when I have something delivered to me, if they meet me at the door, some of them just cut and run and leave shit laying around.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. If they come to the door, I have someone who is happy and nice to me, helping me load the groceries into the house.
That's right.
And for some reason, that means more to me than having to deal with an electronic checkout and being treated, like you said, like some soulless drone that's going and trying to find the Land O'Lakes. I just don't, I don't get it.
No. And, you know, it's interesting to see many companies going back to that home delivery model, you know, that our grandparents had, man, where it was like you had a milkman. He brought your milk twice a week. You know, it was fresh milk. You got it twice a week. You didn't have a gallon of milk that sat there and was going bad.
I know. I remember the milk.
Sam the butcher that brought your steaks, you know, stuff like that. And I said it years ago, whenever I first started this show, when Amazon was talking about bringing back the Christmas catalog. And I was like, that is brilliant. That's brilliant. Mm-hmm. Because what about all those grandparents out there that they can't walk into Toys R Us And they definitely don't know how to use Amazon.
Well, and that's another thing, too.
But they know how to use a catalog.
I had a friend of mine. Well, actually, he was one of my producers, Wes. And he said to me, he said, I used to like going to the store.
Yeah.
But he says, there's something cool about getting on Amazon, ordering a memory card for a computer. Put the order in. He no sooner puts the order in, the next day it's sitting on his doorstep.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is just the most amazing thing ever. And that's the thing. Give me convenience or give me death. Yeah. I think that's the only reason why we haven't raised up to a civil war is because we're getting convenience.
Yeah.
Convenience is keeping us happy. We don't have to deal with people anymore because we get convenience. Take away convenience, we'll be at each other's throats pretty quick, I think. Well, that's the whole thing. America's all about convenience.
You know, the one thing I bring up regularly is the whole Arab Spring. When that happened, that started from a Facebook post, man, and they never found that little account that was like, hey, Hosni Mubarak, what about that guy? Let's get rid of him. You know, they just begat all these people going to the city square and overthrowing the guy.
What about France? We're paying 25 cents extra at the pump for global warming.
Yeah.
Screw that. We're going to riot here in the United States. You're going to pay $2-3 extra for gas because of Ukraine. We all sit there and go, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We'll do it. Okay.
Yeah, I live in Texas. Yeah. We refine it all here. So,
you get spoiled, aren't you?
That's right. That's right.
But, you know, I was in Roswell and they said the same thing. They said, we're spoiled, right? Everything that we have around us is oil.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because all of these things that we're talking about, folks, you know, it may seem like we got off rails a little, but in all honesty, it's all means of control of the paradigm. It is all means of control. And to go right back to where you were talking about a minute ago about, you know, there is a chemical response in our brain to panic, Clyde.
Right.
It's done our body brilliantly for millions of years. It is what helped us survive as animals in the wild while things were hunting us, things like that. The problem is it can be so easily hijacked. So easily hijacked. Fear. Right. Now it's commercial time.
I am I'm very, very, very offended by the fact that everything in this country right now is infantilized.
Yeah.
And that everybody's feeling victimized. Everybody needs to be coddled. Everybody needs to be this and this and this. We need the state to take care of our problems. We need all this to happen. And everybody feels like they're being oppressed. No, it's not that way. It's just that you feel as though that you need to be treated differently because you've had one hell of a life. We all have one hell of a life. Every morning I wake up, I'm in pain. And it's because I'm 59 years old and I'm getting older. And you know, getting old is not for pussies. It's one of those things that you have to deal with. And I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, and they get believing that global warming is real, that the planet's going crazy and that it's all because of global warming. No, last time I checked something, we live on a very violent planet.
Yeah.
And we have earthquakes all the time. We have weather and storms that move through here all the time. What about the times we don't have bad storms? Do they ever talk about that? No. I mean, you look at the irony of the fact that they did the COP28 where they were going to talk about climate change and global warming, and half the people couldn't attend the conference because their planes were basically cracking from the freezing that was going on in Germany.
Yep.
And it was like, you know, there's the irony in that. And the fact that, you know, the others were flying in on their jet planes, they're sucking up all the gas. They had one of their lunches was barbecued hamburgers and French fries. And I'm thinking, what about all those cows that we're not supposed to be eating? What about?
Yeah.
And it's all hypocrisy. And yet we follow along because we don't look beyond the biggest lies that they're telling us.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the fact that so many people are not willing to start thinking their way at an angle out of that hole, Clyde. The whole concept of just being placated to begin with, being happy with the status quo. I think has become kind of the badge of the day, so to speak, you know, where it's like, yeah, as long as you can get along, it's all right.
Right.
And yeah, we used to be a country that strove for more, asked people to strive for more.
Right.
And I am, you know, I am a big believer in hand ups, not handouts. I have said for a long time, the only people I see as being on the dole are our actual government workers. The ones who get free health care for life, you know, things like that. That's being on the dole. like,
right. Exactly.
So, yeah.
There's got to be a reason why they fight like hell to have a job that pays them, what, $200,000 a year?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's more to it than the $200,000 a year they get. They get to speaking engagements for like maybe $40,000 a minute.
Yeah.
That's why they do it. They're career politicians because the money is just endless.
Well, and politics was never supposed to be a career, Clyde. It was never intended to be somebody's sole source of income. As a matter of fact, like originally they thought like politicians shouldn't even get paid. You know, like you're typically a landowner, a lawyer, a doctor, something like that to begin with. You get reimbursed for your time to come and do things, but you were there to be a constituent for your neighbors. And that's what I think we have lost a lot of sight of, man. We very shortly ago had victory gardens in this country.
Oh, yeah. You know,
that was where everybody was pulling the effort. If your neighbor didn't have a couple heads of lettuce for his kids for salad or something, like, you gave it to him. If they needed cords of wood in the winter, you gave it to him.
Yeah.
Now it's like, well, I don't know. I don't really agree with those signs in your lawn. So, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be there to help you come time for that. And the sad thing is, I'm not saying we are close to any kind of revolution, so to speak. But it's coming time where we need to figure out how to help each other out. There is a great and powerful means of control that is in place if we allow it to stay in place. People are not aware of the fact that the Smith-Mundt Act was gutted in 2012. That was basically the law that prevented the federal government from spreading propaganda through the media. Gutted so much so that in the last NDAA that Obama signed on his way out, there was an actual office of anti-propaganda funded, which I'm pretty sure is still just propaganda.
Oh, yeah. It's the Ministry of Truth. They've been pushing that for some time because they look at anything that takes away from their manipulations and their gaslighting as dangerous to the country. Well, no, what's dangerous to the country is the gaslighting. What's dangerous to the country is making people believe that if you get COVID-19, you're immediately going to, it's a death sentence.
Yeah.
That's what they did. When common sense tells you that COVID-19 had a mortality rate of, we had a low mortality rate.
Oh, it was almost like 1%.
Yeah.
1%, it was like 1% of people 2%. Got it. 1% of people died from it.
Yeah, I know. So. But that's the thing. It was that we have the death tolls broadcast every day, like weather reports.
Yeah.
You're facing that every day. You're afraid to go outside for fear that this breathing in the air will make you explode.
How'd that 12 days to flatten the curve work out?
Yeah. I mean, it was just absurd. And people, it doesn't matter if you were the person who said it's absurd. Nobody knew anything about how diseases spread. They didn't know anything about the R-naught factor. They didn't know anything about immunity. None of those things, because there was always a marketing strategy to get you to think otherwise. And that's the whole thing. Everything's based on marketing strategies, based on lobbying.
Yeah.
I mean, the only reason why we have paper straws is because some little girl lobbied and said that turtles die from these straws. Yeah, okay, whatever. I don't think so. Turtles live to be like hundreds of years old. And then all of a sudden some girl feels sorry for turtles and straws and we immediately have to have purple paper straws. It's nonsense.
Yeah,
it's probably less than 1% of the turtles are affected by this. Yeah. You know, we're basically adjusting ourselves to the 1% rather than taking care of the full picture. And that's why, you know, we have to stop down for, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but I'm just saying we have to stop down for transgenders. We have to stop down for certain groups because they're very loud and they're very proud. And they're a, we get told that they're a certain group that gets persecuted. We're all persecuted. We're all being treated differently for our religions and for our ethnic backgrounds, our colors, our creeds.
People forget that we were the wackos, Clyde.
I know. And now sexuality is political.
The people that came to America were the whack jobs. They were the ones that literally could not get along with their neighbor. They were like, yo, man, like, we just want to live our life and do our own religious thing. We're tired of your religious thing.
Right.
You know, and even whenever the American Revolution happened, like less than 20% of America took place in that. The rest of everybody was like, you're crazy. Stop that. Stop that.
Right.
You know, so
I wonder if they thought that they were criminals. I'm sure that the Tories thought that all the patriots out there were criminals.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are plenty of it's like the Democrats today saying that all the people at January 6th were criminals. What about all the people that destroyed Portland? Are they criminals? They got up scot free.
That is what I have said every day since. Pretty sure that federal courthouse is the Constitution. So yeah, when you threaten to burn down a federal courthouse, you are literally attacking the Constitution.
It still has graffiti on it. It still has, you know, and one of the statues we had has been destroyed. They haven't replaced it yet. The city is still ugly after all that. And yet, I remember one of the politicians said, well, what you're hearing about Portland is a myth. None of that's happening. Oh, it happened. I was there. I was upstairs in a studio watching it happen below me. It happened. And I just don't know when anyone will ever acknowledge it, because it's just not cool to acknowledge that these people are doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's not cool to acknowledge that on the direct opposite of the ultraviolet is the infrared. You know, and the problem with any of those polarizing things, the problem with a distillative thought process, the only thing you get out of distillation is volatile substance.
That's right.
You know, so
and that's all we have.
Yeah.
I still feel that something needs to be said about what happened prior to January 6th.
Yes.
Same. They need to call into it. I mean, you know, Trump, one of the things about Donald Trump was that if I were president at that time, and I had the governor of Oregon saying, we're going to allow these people to destroy Portland, and the mayor saying, oh, yeah. And then the attorney general doing that. If I were President Trump, I would have had them arrested. I would have had them arrested. I would have called in the National Guard, and I would have brought law and order back. I mean, he didn't do that.
No,
and so
there you have
the tyrant not doing what a tyrant is supposed to do.
Well,
I, on the other hand, would have been a tyrant. And those people would have been in jail, and they would have been prosecuted to the highest extent of the law.
Yeah.
Because it interfered with our lives here in this city and in this state.
Well, and you're quite literally interfering with the federal court. Like, once again, I'm sorry to tell you folks, but feel free to go back and watch your Schoolhouse Rock. There is not a single person in the House or the Congress that protects the Constitution. That is not their job. Their job is to write laws and propose laws and pass laws. It is the job of the courts to protect the Constitution. It's like people have forgotten these things, and they used to be taught in regular everyday school, man. They used to, like, at least here in Texas, I know we could not get out of seventh grade without passing a Texas history class.
Right.
Wasn't going to happen. You could have straight A's and everything else. If you didn't pass Texas history, you sounds like you need some summer school, or else you ain't going to eighth grade.
History in general, social studies in general, civics in general.
Yep.
All these things that people need to know when they leave, because they need to know their rights. They need to know where they stand when they're being oppressed. A lot of people say, it's like I said to somebody one time on my show, I said, you know, you go back in history, and anybody who basically silences you and tells you to stop your speech and to stop your expression.
Yeah.
They're the bad guys.
Yep.
Because Stalin did it. Hitler did it. Mao did it. Franco did it. Mussolini did it. They all did it.
Look
what they did to their people. Look how these people wound up.
Well, it's quite literally not what we are about. You know, we are about the freedom of expression. We have laws that are specifically there so you can lampoon the president without being arrested. You know, exactly. Things like that. And all of that, once again, the means of control is the ignorance. That right. That is the means of control. The more ignorant, I mean, I hate saying it. I'm Roman Catholic by birth. I spent a year as a Catholic seminarian. There's a reason they kept that thing in Latin instead of the Vulgate for so darn long. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just because people couldn't read. It's because they didn't want the sacred knowledge passed down. It's insanity. It's crazy, you know, and anybody who's willing to ban a book, you may as well be burning them. You know?
Yeah, that's unfortunate. And you go back and you look at, again, who are the ones that burned the books? It was the revolutionaries that wanted to bring about communism,
yeah,
fascism, because they didn't want any uncomfortable, they didn't want anything uncomfortable to be written about.
Yeah.
You know, some things you have a choice not to read, you have a choice not to experience. And now they've learned that it's not just about freedom of speech, it's freedom of reach. Or freedom from reach. Mm. They'll silence you if they need to, and it's not your government always. It's usually people who are uncomfortable with what you say, and then the government steps in, and they're the ones that say you're a domestic terrorist. This is what is ugly: is that we have groups of people that are willing to be fascist themselves and to police everything. That's and we shouldn't have that. We shouldn't be so judgmental in policing of people. That's why we live in the situation we live in now, because we're all infantilized and you're like some people are like the little brother that will tattle on you. And that shouldn't be something that we continue either.
No, absolutely not. And even the idea of a couple few years ago, the FBI adding conspiracy theory to their watch list.
Yeah.
That happened right on the cusp of the Naruto run on Area 51.
Right.
You know, it was like, wow, you couldn't get a better opportunity to just swath gather data on people. If you were there, guaranteed you're a conspiracy theorist or you look at conspiracy theory websites, you're at Area 51 to storm them.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
Like, so, yeah, things like that that you see all the time. I remember I used to work what was it? INSA, the it's an agency that basically oversees all the alphabet agencies. And I used to be flown in as a graphics operator, you know, like the guy in charge of PowerPoints, which was hilarious because, well, since a dude named Snowden, they don't really use PowerPoints. So, I was just backstage listening to this thing for years and even hearing things like generals hop up on stage. Like, we've been trying to be able to get this kind of data in a mass gathering aspect for decades. This is amazing. I remember hearing in 2012 a former FBI agent talking about how they could predictively track where you would be within a 5 to 10 minute accuracy range just from your cell phone data. Just from cell phone metadata, locations, phone calls, when you make them, how you make them, all that. You know, using your Google Maps, everything else. It was like, wow, you know, like they could predict where you would be within 5 to 10 minutes just because of your normal habitual routes.
Algorithms do that.
Oh, yeah. Now. Yeah.
Yeah. They figure out all the possibilities, endings, beginnings. They have it all figured out. And they pretty much, looking at experience and looking at the data, can pretty much figure out what you're going to do next.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And, you know, we've got you for a few more minutes here, Clyde. I don't want to keep you too long. I know you've been with the fans all day. You were up late last night with the show. You've got show tonight, right? Or is it replay tonight?
No, I'm off.
Is it off tonight?
I'm off. I'm going to be doing pointless stuff tonight.
Good. Good. The brain deserves pointless things sometimes, my friend.
Yeah, I know.
What do we do to stop treading water and start swimming, Clyde? How can we start like learning to navigate against the current here? Because we've got to give people more than just a life preserver, you know. Like there's got to be a way for us to.
We can't change the world
no.
unless we talk.
Yeah.
Communication is key. It's the most important thing we can do. You can't have a revolution without a revelation. Mm-hmm. And there are not many people out there that are willing to give the revelations to people. And there are a lot of people out there that don't want to listen.
Yeah.
So I always tell people this. If you want shows like yours and mine and all to continue, you have to focus on keeping them alive. Whatever you can do, spread the word, donate money, participate by calling in or participate by writing letters or whatever. Yeah. I always tell people when my show shows up on a radio station out in the middle of nowhere, do me a favor and call that program director and thank them.
Yes. Yes.
Because a lot of people will call program directors and they'll say, you know, they'll complain or they'll, when the show's taken off the air, they'll complain and say, what did you do with Clyde Lewis? Well, if you would have called them and thanked them before you have to call and complain why I'm gone, they probably would have kept me a lot longer.
Yeah.
So that's the thing is if you really, really, really enjoy the programming that you do, programming that I do, then you really, really have to, like, for example, go to aftermath.media right now. And you go to aftermath.media and you sign up for one of our shows for what, I mean, we have shows dating back some 10 years. We have a chat room. We have a document library. Our document library is amazing because if you're looking for some sort of a document, like, you know, if you're looking for, you know, something that the World Health Organization has talked about, or we got the report from Iron Mountain. We got the Franklin cover up. I mean, all kinds of interesting things, criminal investigation documents, mind control documents, MK Ultra proofs, chemtrail proofs. All those things are there in the document sections. You can use them to show your friends. Look, this is all in writing, guys. Why? I'm not talking in my South End here. I'm talking about, you know, what's really happening. We even have UFO documents that even the vault doesn't have. So we have a lot of good things too. So, I mean, and we have, relationships with people like Jim Keith, the late Jim Keith and, you know, Bill Cooper and a number of people that we always look back at and want to know what they had to say. So, I mean, it's just some really good stuff going on with our aftermath. And if you want things like Aftermath to succeed, you know, please sign up. It's just, you know, it's a virtual playground that everybody can play in. We have our own social media. We have the webinars, which we do that are, you know, we've interviewed some very interesting people. Gerald Casale of Devo, we interviewed him. We interviewed the Trailer Park Boys and just all kinds of people that are really, they're fans of the show, some of them. And so we got a lot of people who listen to Ground Zero that, you know, they want us to all, you know, be happy and they help and they contribute and they show up. So that's a cool thing.
Heck yeah, man. And, you know, it really is. It's funny. Whenever I speak at podcasting conferences, I tell people all the time, like, hold tight, everybody, because mainstream media is following your shoelaces. You know, they have realized that many of us have stolen their listeners away. Many places don't allow you to dial into a browser on a computer at work, but you can always listen to something on your phone, you know?
Right.
So yeah, it's great. And alternative sources like you, once again, Clyde, thank you so much for coming on. I have listened to your show for at least I know for the last decade, better than that, more than likely.
I really appreciate that. I really do because it's, I've been doing this and it's all I do because I can't stop.
Yeah.
Bringing interesting new ideas to people. And that's the whole point. I mean, conspiracy theories, paranormal things, even up to the minute parapolitical stuff.
Yep.
It's not that I take a side in politics. It's just that I want people to see just how bad and how psychotic they can be. And it's,
And that's just it. It is the conversation, because if you're not willing to have the conversation, like I get called capital S skeptic in a lot of groups, you know, because I can spot a lot of non-anomalies, let's just say.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of those, like, Yes, I am a skeptic, and I will wear that proudly, because my job as a skeptic is to take in all information and be waiting for the piece of information that makes me go, well, hot damn, there it is. Yeah. I've been looking for that.
And that's a true skeptic. I mean, people think if they're going to debunk stuff, they're skeptics. No, you've already made your opinion, and that is don't believe it.
Yeah,
you're either a person who doesn't believe or you're a skeptic. And most people, if they're true skeptics, they investigate and they make their decisions based, as you said, on that kernel of truth that comes through if you continue to poke at it. And eventually the truth comes out.
Well, and that's just it. You know, belief belies faith. That means you have to have faith in some. I don't have faith that these things are. I know they are. Mm-hmm. I'm just waiting for the proof.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
And I'm just waiting for it to happen. So, Clyde, thank you so much for your time, man. I appreciate it. I know you've had a busy week of broadcasting. Taking the time really, truly means a lot, because it is about the conversation.
It's a lot of fun. And, I'm glad I was able to have a conversation with you, because I really feel like that, you know, we have a good exchange, you and I, it's amazing that, we have people out there that think the same. There's that symbiotic relationship that I really appreciate.
Absolutely. Same here, man. Please do hold the line while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Clyde Lewis and others at aftermath.media, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can find all of our episodes. That's where you can like, follow, subscribe. That's where you can find not only all the episodes, but you can find our knowledge vault full of declassified government materials, as well as our store where you can find books from all of our guests. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in as always. As we've been saying through this episode, as we say at the end of every episode, it is because of you that the conversation happens. It's because of open minds, open hearts, that the conversation keeps happening. So keep those open minds, keep those open hearts, keep talking with each other, everybody. And remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content, or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.